Hello once again and welcome back to the Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Alan Shartok. There is never a shortage of news on the economy. The falling price of oil has Russia teetering on the brink of disaster, with Ukraine not far behind. Greece appears to be moving closer to a bailout compromise in the Eurozone. China is losing some of the ground it has gained. Meanwhile, the outlook in the United States has remained largely positive and a far cry from the Great Recession of 2008. Here to provide insight and analysis on economic issues making headlines today is Robert Rebelein, Associate Professor of Economics at Vassar College, and get this, and former senior economist for the White House Council of Economic Advisors. It doesn't get any better than that, folks. Give us a call, 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Robert, thanks so much for coming all the way up here from Po-Town.
Thanks for inviting me, Alan.
Getting in the car and doing this, especially in times of snow. I take it was all right coming up?
Didn't have any trouble at all.
That's great.
Freeways were nice and clear.
That's great. Okay, so anyway, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about some of the things that we have to look out for. Our producer, Jessica, was very interested in my asking you about the way the world is working economically right now. So in a couple of pithy sentences...
The world is working, huh?
Yeah.
That's a big question,
yeah,
big issue.
No, I know that. And
you said a couple other things. We got some things going on in Russia, Greece.
Ukraine.
And China. And there's other emerging markets around the globe that we need to keep an eye on. I'm interested in some of the countries in South America. Brazil, for example, has the sixth largest economy in the world, and we don't hear much about that. They just continue to grow. China, the IMF announced a couple months ago, now has a bigger economy, bigger GDP than does the United States, at least in some measures. Oil prices, it should be good for us that they're down. There's some concern about investment in the U.S., but for the most part, people are happy to see lower oil prices. And as you said, the economy in the U.S. is generally doing well. People are coming back into the labor market. We're seeing job growth. That's some of the strongest we've seen in many years. And probably the main problem is that wages have not been growing, not been keeping up with some of the economic growth that we've been seeing. And so concerns about inequality continue to dog the U.S. economy.
Yeah. And, you know, I guess the question that I always want to ask you and your colleagues about economics is, Obama is now, fortuitously for him, he's riding the wave, as we used to say out on Fire Island. He's riding the wave, caught the wave. But is it a matter of luck? Or is it just a matter of luck that the wave comes along and you're a successful president, and if you take over the presidency or the governorship at a time of want, you're in trouble?
I'm not sure Obama felt very lucky 6 years ago when he took over the presidency, and he would have said that he's very unlucky to be coming in those circumstances. Things have gone slowly, progressively better since then. And if you would ask me, is there anything in particular that he's done that was really good, that really helped the economy, I would have a hard time pointing to any single thing. There's been little things, but no, he's just kind of let the economy continue to grow.
Rode the wave. Now, you saw in the beginning, when you're that period you're talking about, instead of saying, okay, I'm going to do a Rooseveltian sort of look at the way in which we do things, he said, okay, we'll prop up the banks, except for one or two, and we'll prop up the car companies. So he went along by strengthening the existing institutions, don't you think?
I would agree with that. And you might want to check your timing a little bit, because the TARP bill, the banks being propped up, was actually under the Bush administration.
Interesting.
And it was what Obama got credit for in the early in his tenure was the big stimulus bill that was a combination of tax cuts and spending increases and support for the states. But in general, I think you make a good point that it was about propping up the sorts of traditional and stable things, or things that were already doing well in the economy. And economists throughout this time have said that the U.S. continues to have very good fundamentals. in the sense of we have a good environment in which to do business. We have good education structures that create highly skilled workers that can do the high-tech jobs and continue to create new technologies, new innovations, and those are things that are important for helping an economy get ahead.
You know, I'm always fascinated by when the invasions happen. So I remember when Japan was going to buy everything in the United States.
Yeah.
Where are they now?
Well, they've kind of had this malaise for the last 25 years, they've struggled with some deflation. They had a property bubble, a real estate bubble that burst.
Yeah.
And it was not dissimilar to what the U.S. experienced in the housing market crisis. And actually, that's been something very useful for us to look at as an example of what we want to make sure doesn't happen here in the U.S. So we've looked at some of the Japanese things. But yeah, for a while, there was a Japanese company that owned Rockefeller Center in New York City. And they were buying up land and companies both on the East Coast and the West Coast, and we were very worried about that. But fortunately, for us at least, they had the recession, and that has not come to be a problem.
So is there a hidden hand in this somewhere? You know, every once in a while, I'm not much of a conspiratorialist, but every once in a while I say, well, wait a second now, how did that happen? How did the oil prices really go down? You know, who talked to who? Did we talk to the Saudis because we were angry at the Russians? I mean, you are a senior economist in the White House. Does it ever occur to you that there may be more than the obvious here?
Certainly, people wonder those questions from time to time. The experience that I had, I did not see any evidence of those kinds of things happening. I was actually really impressed with the integrity of the people that I worked with. I had a chance to work a little bit under the Bush administration, excuse me, and also under the Obama administration, and all of the people there were primarily interested in doing things that would help the country, and not trying to manipulate things in the way you're describing.
There you go. Okay, we're going to take one phone call real fast. Let's go to Joe in Orange County. Joe, you're on.
Yes, hi, Professor.
Hello.
Interesting conversation. Professor, we've got $18 trillion in debt. We're printing money. Maybe the short-term outlook is good, but where are we going down the road if we're selling short-term? I mean, when Obama came in, the debt was at what level? It moved recently from $17 to $18 trillion.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're mortgaging the future. I don't understand economists anymore that just slough that off. I don't understand.
Okay, Joe, you asked your question. Now we're going to get an answer. Go ahead.
All right. It's true that we have about $18 trillion worth of debt. Some of that has come from, as you say, printed money in the sense that the Federal Reserve Bank has bought some of that debt from the Treasury Department. But most of it is borrowed from places around the world. About 55-60% of it is borrowed from places within the United States. So insurance companies, many banks in the United States, many individuals, if you have any savings bonds, those are part of the national debt. We've also borrowed heavily internationally. We owe China or investors in China over $1 trillion. I think we're up to about $1.4 trillion. We owe people in Japan about $1.2 trillion and Europeans over $1 trillion. And as I say that, one of the things I want to be clear about, this is not the Chinese government or the Japanese government that we owe money to. It is people in and companies and banks in those countries. In terms of where are we going in the long run, you make a really good point, and this is something that I'm kind of concerned about. Alan and I were talking earlier. My dissertation work was on national debt. And so one of the things that I know economists have looked at is there a limit? Is there a limit to how much debt we can have? And we don't look at that in terms of trillions of dollars, but in terms of relative to the size of the economy. So our economy is approaching $18 trillion. We have about 100% debt to GDP ratio. Well, looking around the world as to see, is that a problem? Greece got in trouble recently, and their debt to GDP ratio was about 160% when they got in trouble. Many of the other developing economies, England, Germany, Australia, many of them have 90% debt to GDP ratios. So we're not really out of line in that sense. And if you look further, Japan has a debt to GDP ratio of over 200%. And they haven't gotten in trouble because of that. So it's not really clear what the limit is, and it seems like what the politicians are doing, because it's not the economists borrowing the money, it's the politicians who are deciding we want to spend more and tax less, and so we need to make up the difference by borrowing. They're the ones that are saying, well, $15 trillion wasn't a problem, so why should $16 trillion be? And $16 trillion wasn't a problem, so let's try $17. And $18 trillion doesn't seem to be a problem, so let's try $20.
It's crazy. Let me ask you this question. We've kept interest rates artificially low with the Fed practices. What's going to happen when interest rates do go up, if they finally take the cap off that? You're not going to have people investing in the stock market anymore. They're going to move it into maybe savings accounts if the rates ever go up decently. What's going to happen to all that debt when interest rates do go up because they've been held artificially low?
Okay, I know Professor is concerned about that because we talked about it, but Robert, you want to do it real quick.
So the Fed has been working very hard to extend the maturity of the bonds that they have and trying to take advantage of long-term rates being really low. So short-term rates rising shouldn't have as big an impact as you might be worried about.
Okay. Listen, Joe, we've got to take a break. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Professor.
Yep.
Thank
you. 1-800-348-2551. You can hear there's a guy who really knows what he's talking about. We will be right back with you.
Support comes from Laurie Stillwell CPA PC, providing tax and accounting services for businesses and their owners in Saratoga Springs and beyond. StillwellCPA.com. The Center for Extended Care on University Drive in Amherst, a family-owned and operated nursing center offering rehab, long-term care, and Alzheimer's specialty care. CECAA.com. HMT at the Spa Little Theater, presenting The Complete History of America Abridged. Weekends, February 13th through March 1st at the Spa Little Theater, Saratoga Spa State Park, homemadetheater.org. And Autobahn Service, Great Barrington, Massachusetts, offering service, repair, and diagnosis of imports, specializing in late model Volkswagen, Audi, and BMW. AutobahnTechnic.com.
And we are back with our wonderful guest, Professor Robert Revelein, Associate Professor of Economics at Vassar College, former senior economist for the White House Council of Economic Advisors. Let's go to Tommy in Neversink. Okay, Tommy, you're on.
Hi. I was wondering, I'm aware that oil is on the commodities market. Mm-hmm. Wouldn't it be better for the country if it weren't, if we could set a price, say $3, like we do utilities, and say it's going to be that one price for a period of time, wouldn't it be better for the consumers and for the oil companies so they know what to depend on and all kinds of businesses know what to depend on?
There may be some possible advantages to that, like you described, there's more certainty. But what you're talking about is a price control and having the government dictate what will the price of a product be. And we've had experiments with that in the past, and it's really a bad idea. It really doesn't work well at all.
But this is a special product, though.
I understand, but remember that it is provided by private companies and by the marketplace.
Right.
And so we want to make sure that there's enough incentives there for oil companies to still go out and drill. And they need
to. But they probably don't like it being $2 a gallon now, do they?
There are some that are doing just fine at that price. It's not the frackers. It's not the oil shale that's going to be as profitable there. But the traditional oil is still, they're still making money at those prices.
Tommy,
right.
Tommy, always wonderful to hear from you. Thanks for calling. Appreciate
Thank
it.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, let's go to Abigail in Kingston. Hi, Abigail. How you doing?
Hi, I'm doing fine, Alan, and thank you so much. Your analysis in the very beginning was probably all I had to say. But the last caller brought up something very interesting about the oil and corporations, et cetera. And all of that money, supposedly, that was made by all these oil companies is probably being put into new providers, such as wind and solar and or we hope that that's the case. Anyway, I started out by asking how our speaker could or would define growth. And then the other question I had was, what caused the reduction of wages in the mid-70s. So,
okay, two good questions. We're going to give you two fast answers.
All right. So when economists think about economic growth, we think about a country producing more stuff. So more cars, more computers, more houses, more clothing, more food, more education, more stuff. That's economic growth.
Yeah, I think we have to define those particular things with more distinctions. Stuff. I love the word. I use it all the time.
I actually use it in my classes. I say we want to make more stuff.
By the way, let me ask you: did you read?
Wait, Abigail! You already asked two questions. That's going to be
one at a time. So when we talk about economic growth, when more things are produced, that generates more income for people. And some of that income goes to workers and some of it goes to the owners of the company. And what we've seen in the last couple of decades is that more and more of that extra income is going to the owners of the company and it's not going into wages. And that's why wages haven't been growing as much. And there's a lot of reasons as to why that's been happening. But it's something that has started to gain some national attention and to work to try and change that.
And is the decline of unions part of that?
The decline of unions is part of it. The increase in outsourcing, international production chains is part of that. Also, improvements in technology have reduced the role of labor.
Now, the other thing is that China, which you mentioned, the aforementioned China, which you brought up, made a lot of stuff for a long time.
China's continuing to make a huge amount of stuff that gets exported to the United States, and they likely will continue to do that for many, many years.
And why is it to our advantage that they are allowed to do that?
So international trade always produces winners and losers. And I don't mean just one country wins and one country loses, but within a country, there are winners and losers. And the reason we like having China produce stuff and export it to the United States is because the consumers get to buy things more cheaply. The losers in our country, though, are the people who are manufacturing that stuff. Mm-hmm. So we get cheaper clothes, we get cheaper machinery, we get cheaper computers and electronic gadgets than we would if we had to make it here. But that means we have fewer jobs. So you gain on one hand, you lose on the other.
Abigail had a second part of that question.
You've said so much.
No. You had two questions you asked us in the beginning.
I think the other one was about wages.
That's right. It was about wages, but I kind of know the answer. Because you implicit in your answer to the last question was the notion of shipping abroad, of getting it cheaper, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But we do have, which is an incredible growth pattern, it's an idea, it's a thing.
Abigail, I'm so sorry. You're busting all up. We're going to have to leave it with that. Thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Let's go to Pete in Scotia, 1-800-348-2551. Your chances of getting in now, folks, are just about 100%. 1-800-348-2551. And I'm not even an economist. Go ahead, Pete.
Thank you. I had a question, actually two questions for the professor. One has to do, and they're following up on what was going on here, but how do we get to a steady state economy such as Herman Daly wrote about years and years ago back when I was in college? It seemed to make sense that kind of living within your means, not borrowing and drilling and using everything up, you know, now.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
What kind of policies, what kind of thought process, what kind of economic discussions are going on about that. I don't hear very much. I hear what the stock market's doing, and occasionally, as you mentioned, the wages are going down, and there's the issue of fairness.
Well, just not growing.
Yeah, and the idea of infinite growth on a finite planet, Fritz Schumacher talked about that as well in Economics, Small is Beautiful. And I see nothing of that in the mainstream economics discussions.
No, and you probably won't. And you mentioned a couple of things. One is, are there economic issues? And the other, what kind of mindset, what kind of thoughts need to be happening? And it's really about the attitudes that people have. There's not very many people that are comfortable living with what they have for the rest of their lives. The reality is that most people want more. And part of that's looking around. They see their neighbors with more. They see people in other countries. They see wherever it is, other people have more. Therefore, I want more. That's a kind of a human attitude. And the other thing is that we continue to have population growth. And as long as we're having more people, even if everybody said, okay, I'm comfortable with what I have, I don't need more, the fact that we're having more people means that as an economy or as a society, we're going to need more stuff. So because of both of those things, we really don't tend to talk very often about a steady state economy.
And China has just announced the end of their two children policy, or their
one child policy. Well, I didn't hear they announced the end. They've been scaling it back. There's things if there's a marriage between two single child people,
right,
they can have two children.
Amazing.
There's
it falls well into what you were, the paradigm you were just talking about.
Yes, yes.
Talking to. Hey, Pete, this is a great question. Thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's go to Laura in Woodstock. Okay, Laura, you're on.
Hi. My question was, how important a role do you feel the environment plays in our economy? Since we obviously live on a finite planet with finite resources, mm-hmm. and we seem to be running through a lot of them really quick in ways that are destructive to humankind and, you know, existence overall. And I'm just wondering how you factor that into your economic outlook.
So there's a lot of work around the world being done by economists and environmentalists to try and get a better way of measuring the value of the environment. Whether it's the value of the environment today or the damage that we're doing to it today, consequences that may not manifest for 100 years, 200 years, 500 years, trying to do a better job of measuring that so we can compare it to the things that we want to spend money on today, which is oftentimes providing food and clothing and shelter for people in the world today. And the problem is that we don't have good ways of measuring the environment, of evaluating and comparing it to. There's a family on the streets who doesn't have enough food or doesn't have shelter for tonight. How do we decide which of those to spend money on?
And, but do you agree that there is really enough for everyone, and it's really a matter of distribution and how things are run in this world? And you know, it just seems like so many thousands of jobs could be created for things that would actually benefit the planet and society, for that matter, instead of what our economy seems to grow on, which is, you know, what percent of our economy, 60, 65% goes into the military-industrial complex?
No, it's not even anywhere near that.
Well, whatever.
Okay.
What
I understand what you're saying,
say?
Though. I understand what you're saying. And I'm going to come back again to, we don't know, we don't have a good way of valuing those things. And our economy right now is based on providing things for people that they are willing to pay for, that they are willing to give something up for. And what people are telling us in the markets is that they're just not that willing to give up maintaining the quality of the environment in exchange for sometimes food and clothing today. And
because they don't see a direct correlation.
A direct correlation. They don't see that, you know, people, one of the things I think about is in the airlines, if you're ever flying, they give this announcement, they say, make sure that your air mask is secure before you try and help somebody else. The same kind of thing. Mm-hmm. You want to make sure and eat today and take care of yourself and your kids today before you worry about, are they going to be okay tomorrow? And
I would argue that we are facing problems right now, you know, in our weather and everything else. And, you know, that's where I think there could be a lot of job creation, and there could be, you know, ways to, I know it's, well, I'm talking about extreme changes to the way we're doing business now, but I do believe it's possible. And I
Laura, you made that clear. What I want to say is I thank you for your call, because it's a great call and a very important. I don't think any of us disagree with you. Thanks a lot. Thanks for calling.
Thank you,
thanks,
Alan.
Laura.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Yep. Let's go to Bob in Orange County. Bob in Orange County, you're on.
I guess that brings up another question I had, but real quickly. Green jobs, they never materialized. And, I mean, that was something that I think the President of the United States was an ideologue about in terms of creating green jobs. We didn't have 5 million green jobs created in this country, and none of them were sustainable, Professor.
So what's the question there?
Are
we going to get green jobs? You know, part of the issue is, how do you measure a green job? So one of the examples we had when I was in Washington was, suppose that we build a wind farm somewhere, and the people who are staffing the wind farm, obviously those should count as green jobs. But on the way into the wind farm is a gas station, and somebody has to run the gas station. Is that a green job? The gas station only exists because you need to give gas to the people who are coming and going, working at the wind farm. You know, so part of it's measuring green jobs. Part of it is that many of the green technologies that we have are very technology intensive. They don't require a lot of work, a lot of people to be working at them.
But they're not going to, they determine that in Spain. I mean, in Spain, they want to go to an entire green economy, and it couldn't sustain itself, and it collapsed. That's part of the problem Spain had as well. I don't understand why the president continued on with the concept of, you know, having an economy that sustains itself on green technology and green jobs.
I don't think that any of his policies ever actually sought to pursue that. He might have talked about it a little bit, but nothing that he did would actually pursue that kind of outcome.
About Solyndra.
What about Solyndra?
It collapsed.
He tried. It collapsed. It didn't work.
$500 million.
It was not a good investment for the government in that case.
Hey, Bob, thank you very much for the call. Appreciate
Thanks,
it. Yeah.
Take care. Bye. Great call.
Let's go to Bernadette in New Paltz. Bernadette, you're on. Bernadette.
Alan, you got somebody in Albany.
Who we got?
Hey, Jim, how are you there?
Okay, put Jim up in the front. Go ahead.
Hey, okay. Hey, good program.
We'll get Bernadette next. Go ahead. Oh, go ahead,
okay.
Jim.
Hey, it's good to have an expert in economics, particularly someone who worked for the Bush administration and the Obama administration.
I try to be non-biased.
Great. Here's my question. Would the Bush administration have bailed out the car companies, which the Obama administration did, and which was by far the most important thing Obama administration did for the economy, right, and national security? If we lost the car companies, it would have been a catastrophe.
You know, it's hard to know if they would have done that or not. I agree with you that bailing them out, or at least that major industry that employs millions and millions of workers in our economy, we needed to do something to protect those jobs and to keep those people working. And so I expect that the Bush administration, this is just guessing, that they would have done something about that, too. One of the things I can say is
that's interesting. As
we were leaving with the Bush administration, you know, the economy was going poorly. I could be more extreme than that, but things were going badly at the end of the Bush administration. We were talking about, what should we do? Should we have a bailout program? Should we do more than just the TARP package? We had cash for clunkers. Should we do more? And there was some uncertainty about how would that be received, because the Bush would only get any blame that was available. He wouldn't get any credit if it paid off in the long run, and because he'd be out of office by the time any benefits came from that. So I think they made a political decision and decided, let's just wait. Let's, you know, Obama's coming in. There's a new Congress coming in. And we'll just let them decide what they want to do with it. So I think after TARP, the Bush administration kind of said, okay, we've done what we're going to do. If there's anything urgent that we need to do before Obama comes in, we'll take care of it. But otherwise, we want to leave the room for him to have some policies.
Yeah, you got me wondering now what you said. Which makes it even more puzzling. Why would Governor Romney, come out against the car bailout?
Good question. Maybe he thought that the way businesses are supposed to be run in the U.S. is to let them fail.
Are we talking about George Romney or Mitt?
George Romney. I'm sorry. Thank
Mitt
you,
Romney.
Alan.
Yeah.
Okay. Hey, Jim, we got to let you go.
Hey, all right. Thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot. Yeah. Okay. Very quickly, we're going to go to Bernadette. Finally, Bernadette gets a chance, I hope. Bernadette, is that you?
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead. Real quick.
Real quick. Question would be about the 60 Minutes episode about corporate tax and companies leaving the country. And the other concern that I have is China stealing patents.
Let me start with that one, because that's actually kind of an interesting one. China's a developing economy. And I think of China as being in about the same place that the U.S. was maybe 100, 125 years ago. The U.S. was then a developing economy. We were up and coming in the world. And we were competing with the global powers of Spain and France and the UK. And the reason I mention this is because the U.S., there were people in the U.S. that were stealing patented material from England, from Spain, from other countries. And we were saying, look, we're a developing country. We don't have the technology to develop these things. And so we're just going to take these ideas. And I find it rather ironic that now that the shoe is on the other foot, so to speak, and we're the developed economy, we're complaining now. and saying, well, they can't do this, and we were doing the same thing.
Hey, that would be easy for you to say. That's easy for you to say.
Yeah.
If you own the patent, you wouldn't
be so
happy.
It's much easier.
Yeah.
That's true.
Hey, hey, Bernadette, I'm so sorry for cutting you short, but we do have a break we got to get to. And thanks for the very good question. Appreciate it.
All right.
Yeah, bye.
Support comes from Lori Ilvesacker, Coldwell Banker Village Green Realty Woodstock, a professional realtor with 30 years of experience, specializing in the greater Woodstock area home market and in finding acreage for building new. 845-901-6129. The Preservation League of New York State, Albany, New York, announcing their new website with more information about membership, grants, and loans. So our past has a future. PreserveNYS.org. And NBT Bank, offering trust and fiduciary services, investment management, and retirement planning for individuals and businesses. NBTBank.com.
Okay, so we are with... Robert Rebeline, Associate Professor of Economics at Vassar College and former senior economist for the White House Council of Economic Advisors. Boy, Vassar's lucky to have you. So,
thank you, Alan.
So I guess I want to ask a question, because the last questioner who we had to cut off a little short had posited, what would happen if we paid everybody a minimum wage of $20 an hour?
If we paid wow, doubling the minimum wage.
Yeah.
That would certainly increase cost for small businesses, for businesses across the board. One of the major consequences that I think about that is, what do we do with all the people who are currently making a little bit more than minimum wage?
Uh-huh. So
minimum wage, maybe they're making $10, $12, $15 an hour. I have a friend, for example, who's been working at a minimum wage job, or started working at a minimum wage job like 8 years ago, and he's happy. He's proud of the raises that he's gotten over time. And to be told that now he's going to make $20 an hour, that's great, but he's been working hard to distinguish himself from the people who are making the minimum wage. And so it's not just the people at the minimum wage level, but all the people above that would have to be given wage increases. Huge increase in the amount of spending for businesses. It would, economists are often in, I was going to say often in agreement. That's not quite right. There's a widespread agreement that minimum wage laws often contribute to unemployment. So what I'd expect with an increase in the minimum wage is that there would be fewer people working at that minimum wage.
Interesting. Interesting. That's something that, frankly, the Republicans always argue.
Right. The economists would agree with that.
They might have a point.
Yeah.
Okay. Let us go. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Wait a second now. Reed, I think I stole your thunder, didn't I? Reed?
Oh, yeah.
Did I just steal your thunder about the $20 minimum wage?
Yes, you did. But this is what I want it hooked in with, though. Throw the Great Society in the trash bin. You scrap the Great Society and combination with $20 an hour, and suddenly, well.
Let me make sure I got this straight. By scrapping Great Society, you want to do away with welfare programs, with unemployment programs,
Medicare,
with Medicare and
Medicaid,
Social Security?
Yeah, Social Security.
Yep. Scrap the whole thing and give everybody $20 an hour.
Well, give everybody $20 an hour who's actually got a job.
Well,
what are you going to do with the people who don't have jobs? Because there won't be as many jobs available.
Well, in your previous comments, you said, yes, we've got to bring, the Chinese are manufacturing our goods. So it's obvious that you'd have to put some tariffs in there to say, let's get America back to work.
So let me come back to that, because there was one more thing I wanted to add to that, and I just want to make it clear. Economists have done a lot of studies about how much of job loss in the U.S., especially in the manufacturing sector, how much of that is due to outsourcing to countries like China and Mexico and Malaysia and Singapore, India. How much is it due to outsourcing, and how much is due to technology improvements? And the results that we find is that it's about half and half. Technology improvements have replaced a lot of workers as well. My understanding, for example, in the agricultural industry, that they've been working to develop automated pickers, automated harvesters, in this, especially in the southwestern part of the country, that will replace thousands of workers. And this has nothing to do with having production happen in China. So I want to be clear. It's not just about outsourcing jobs.
And then the other part of that, Bob, is that some of what goes on with China has to be considered to be reciprocal.
Absolutely.
So that when we put tariffs on, we're asking for a certain amount of trouble, right?
Yeah. The reality with China is that we buy much more from them than they buy from us. But talk about the other countries, it is more balanced. And one of the things that they buy from us is manufacturing machinery and equipment, things that are high-value stuff for us to produce.
So why do we put up with China then? In other words, why don't we get tougher on them?
They sell us stuff cheaply, and they buy stuff that we're really good at producing. And as a result of that, and they lend us over $1 trillion.
Oh, yeah, there is that. hey, Reed, thank you, Ben. Thanks.
One more comment, though?
Sure.
Then how about, and this falls into the environmental green jobs thing, FDR Job Corps?
So
put people to work.
So I actually would be in favor of something like that. I think that there is a number of projects around the country that we could – they're infrastructure investments, you know, working on schools, working on roads. Myself, I grew up in the upper Midwest, and there's a lot of national parks that I used to go to as a kid that would have signs about how the trails and some of the equipment, some of the structures in the parks were created under civilian conservation corps projects.
Yes.
And things like Hoover Dam was a CCC project.
All right.
So I think that those would be really good projects.
Thanks, Reed. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Yep. Thank you, Buck.
All right. We're coming down to the end here. We've got a little time, so let's go. Let's go to James in Hudson, who wants to ask one of my favorite questions. James.
Yes. I'm sorry. Playing my shirt. What is going to happen? Capitalism only works if there are people there to buy things. If we have, like, robots and we just keep cutting the bottom line until there's no one to buy things, it's not going to function.
That is true. And you make a really good point. And there are some people who have worried that we are heading towards kind of a two-tier society where there's people who manufacture things from the capital side. They have the capital that's used to manufacture things. And there's a huge pool of labor, some of whom may be lucky enough to have jobs, many of whom are not. And that kind of bimodal distribution of wealth, how do we deal with that? And, you know, we're having awareness of that possibility and the problems that would come with that is one of the biggest things that's going to help us be able to make sure that doesn't happen. One of the something I'm very optimistic about, though, is that we're very creative. That's one of the things the U.S. does best, is create new ideas, new technologies, new products. And as long as we continue to invent new things that people want to have and that somebody needs to produce, we're going to be able to continue to have jobs for people.
Yeah, and
well, I'm a big fan of Dickens, my second favorite writer, and I think we're moving closer and closer to a Dickensian society.
Well, you know, go look at a book by my ex-colleague from Rutgers, long gone, Sebastian de Grazia, who wrote a book called Of Time, Work, and Leisure. He laid it all out in the 60s, and he was right then, and he's right now. It's happening.
No, and I'm sorry. I mean, I think this country is just going totally in the wrong direction.
Well, what is the right direction? Kill all the robots?
No, not the robot. No, FDR. I think I'm a progressive. And I'm not, like, with everything on the left, but I think FDR was the best thing that ever happened because when times get tough, you have to spend money. And that's why we had the Greatest Generation.
When times get tough, we need to spend more money. We need to have some support from the government. And when times are better, then we need to have that borrowing paid off. And we haven't done that. And that's been one of our problems of late, is that it's really limited our ability to spend more to deal with some of the problems that we have.
James, say hello to everybody in Hudson. We love that town. Thanks a lot.
Okay, thanks very much. Thanks so much for listening to me. Thanks. Bye.
Well, let's go to Ron in Hudson Falls, which is Nudson.
Hello?
Go ahead, Ron. You're on.
Well, you mentioned that everybody's paying attention now to income inequality.
Yes.
But from a practical standpoint, what can you do to work on the problem?
What we've done in the past is primarily raise taxes on the wealthy. You know, I think it was right after World War II, the top marginal tax rate was over 90%.
Can you imagine that?
So you do that, you raise the tax, but what do you do with that money then? That gets it down to the lower wage earner.
No, so there was a study a couple of years ago that looked at tax rates on businesses and the amount of investment that businesses do as a result of different tax rates. And what they found was that businesses invest more when taxes are high. The thinking is that the logic behind that, when taxes are high, people don't take as much money out of the business. They leave it in the business, and they reinvest. Then the business reinvests the money, expanding the business, expanding
right.
the
so
company.
So they don't have to pay taxes on income because they reinvested it.
That's right. And
yeah.
when tax rates are low, then business owners figure, well, let's take the money out. I can afford to pay a little bit of tax, and then I'll go spend the money. And we don't get the reinvestment. So taxes being high will help companies retain their earnings and find ways to reinvest them, rather than us going out and spending the top 1%, going out and spending all of the money.
Why don't you hear that on, like, Fox News?
It's not popular.
I've never heard that, but that certainly makes sense.
Thanks, Ron. Appreciate
it. Okay.
Bye-bye. Okay. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Very quickly, because we are running out of time, Professor, could you just, I know that healthcare is very salient for you. Just tell us why you think we have some problems there.
Healthcare is the issue that concerns me the most about our economy, looking longer term. We know the baby boomers have started to retire. A pertinent statistic, one that I try and get all of my students to know about, is the fact that in the United States now, every single day, 10,000 people are turning age 65.
Right.
Every single day. And that's going to continue for the next 20 years.
Wow.
So we are, and it's not just about the baby boomers. The baby boomers are the ones that are aging and turning 65 now, but we're turning into a society where we have a much older population, and we're going to need to figure out how to deal with not just the baby boomers when they're old, but older people in general. And that has a lot to do with healthcare. Healthcare has already gotten to the point where we spend more than 1/6 of our U.S. economy on healthcare, and that's going to continue to grow in the years ahead. And about half of that is paid for by the federal government.
And how do we stop the rate of growth? I mean, every day somebody's going to invent another pill, another machine. I have a bad shoulder. I want an MRI of it. I know you're going to argue that the insurance companies are saying no to a lot, but even they, you know, have to compete with each other.
So from an economic perspective, we have a limited amount of resources, not just about healthcare, but about things we do with our economy. And the more resources we put into healthcare, the less we have left over to do other things, whether it's environmental things, whether it's military, whether it's taking care of people at home, whatever it is. So somewhere along the line, and Alan and I, we were talking about this earlier, that my statement is somebody has to make decisions about who's going to get what healthcare procedures. Somebody has to make those decisions. Right now, it's the insurance companies making those decisions. And we sometimes look across the border up north and Canada and other countries where they have universal healthcare, and we hear about wait times.
Mm-hmm.
We hear about long wait times for what we think of our procedures that you can get done in a matter
of
weeks.
Sure, and the rich Canadians come right down here and get
and
what
the rich
they want.
Canadians come down here, and so do the Europeans, for that matter.
Yeah. I'm sorry, Bob, but when you say someone has to make this decision, and I press you on the someone, you're going to have a hard time telling me who that someone is.
Somebody is making those decisions now.
Right.
We are rationing healthcare in the United States. As you said, we are doing it, Alan.
We are
doing it. The insurance companies are the gatekeepers.
Yeah, you want to have...
In those other countries, it's the government that's the gatekeeper.
Yeah.
Those are the two choices.
No.
It's either got to be the government or the insurance companies.
Well,
which one do you want?
No, I don't think you're right. And I say that even though you are a senior economist in the White House, I got to tell you, I don't think anybody has the cojones to take that on, because people, I want my shoulder MRI'd because it hurt.
Great. What are you going to give up in order to make sure that everybody can get that MRI?
Absolutely
and
nothing.
Well, that's going to be a problem then. I guess where we agreed earlier was we're just going to keep spending more money on health care, and the government will have to borrow more and tax more, and then we'll just keep getting deeper into this hole.
Well, you're terrific. Okay, let's go to Rich. Rich is number four, and he's not there. Number three. Let's try number three, see what happens. Who's on number three? Who are you?
This is Rich.
Hi, Rich. Okay.
Hey, quick question about the inequality in relation to the unions. Has there been any study out there that kind of shows, you know, the middle class pretty much is disappearing as the union is? Has there been anything out there that shows that there's a relation between the two? I mean, the union is pretty much dying, and so is the middle class. I mean, there's got to be some sort of...
Well, remember that correlation does not imply causation, that's a common fallacy in economic analysis. You're right that income inequality has risen. I would describe that as being caused by other things rather than the demise of the union, and say that they've happened at the same time. Certainly, the demise or the decrease in unionization membership has led to a decrease in bargaining power by workers. And you could argue that that's meant that workers get a smaller share of the pie and the rich people get a larger share. Yeah, there's probably something to do with that. There's also differences in tax rates, differences in policies about employment issues. And I think there's lots of things that have contributed to income inequality, not just demise of
the union. You think the union has a part in economy, in our economics, you know, going forward, or you don't think we need the unions anymore?
I think that unionization could be one possible solution to income inequality. If people really get fed up with the amount of wealth held by the 1%, they're going to need to group together, and a union is an obvious way to do that. But how do you get unions across multiple industries?
And how do you get unions to behave themselves?
Yeah.
So that's another thing.
Barack Obama was supposed to do something, was supposed to address that when he took office 6 years ago.
Okay. Hey, listen, I'm sorry we can't give you any more time. Thanks, Rich. Okay, so very quickly, somebody wants to know, since the economies of some countries around the world are growing, how much is due to the black market? In other words, heroin and things like that. Is that why economies grow?
So we do not actually measure the black market.
Uh-huh.
When we measure GDP, when we measure economic output, we're measuring things that we have good data for. So we don't know, for example, we don't know how much prostitution or drug trade or illegal gambling or cigarette trade is in the United States.
Which
we
is
have
why they
estimates
always,
of those.
Yeah, which is why always they say estimates have said.
But they're not factored into GDP in our country.
No, but they're not. And so the answer to the very good question is we don't know.
We don't know.
Okay. And very quickly, we'll go to Larry. Okay. Larry, it's got to be a one-sentence question and no more. I'm giving you five words. What do you got?
I was wondering if you had read Jeremy Rifkin's last book, The Net Zero Marginal Cost, and if you could just talk about it.
Sorry, I did not read that one yet.
Okay.
Okay, I guess that
that answers that question. Thanks a lot.
Shortest answer I've given all day.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay, and very quickly, Jennifer, you got a five-word question?
Yes. How is
Two,
ecology three. And environment really playing into the trade for our natural resources in upgrading infrastructure?
Jennifer, it's a great
economic
question.
Economic development.
It's a great question. We could spend about 3 hours and a couple of PhD theses on it, but we are out of time. And next time, we'll try to get you a little early in the show, okay? Thanks, Jennifer. Okay, so we're just about out of time. Thanks to everyone who called in, and there are a lot of people. I'd also like to thank Robert Reveline for joining us today, professor at Vassar College and former White House senior economic advisor. And Bob, you are terrific. I mean, really good.
Thanks. It's been a pleasure being here.
And we sure hope you'll come back. Support for the Vox Pop comes from Upstate Divorce Mediation, specializing in helping couples who are seeking a legal separation or divorce. Offices in Albany, Saratoga, and Catskill, Upstate, Divorce, Mediation.com. United Way of the Greater Capital Region, Albany, working to create opportunities in education, financial stability, and health in the community. Live United, give, dot advocate, dot volunteer, United Way, GCR.org. And House and Son, True Value Hardware and Just Ask Rentals, Woodstock, New York, specializing in energy-saving ideas for home winterizing since 1932. Behind every project is a True Value. Housed.com and Habitat Post and Beam, South Deerfield, Massachusetts, designing and manufacturing energy-efficient post and beam homes and additions throughout the Northeast since 1972. Postandbeam.com. Thanks again, everybody, for joining us on Vox Pop. Our engineer has been Zach Malloy. Your calls were answered expertly by Dan Goldstein. I'm Alan Chartok. Stay tuned now for a news update.